What Maine voters said at the polls on Tuesday. There were winners and losers, at least in most of the races. One has not yet been decided. But beyond choosing the people they want to represent them in Washington and Augusta, what did Maine voters really say when they turned out in record numbers, in the rain, to cast their ballots? I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, we'll explore some of the themes that emerged from this year's midterms at the national level, and how they may or may not be related to what happened here in Maine. We'll also look forward to learn more about how Maine's second district congressional race will be decided, and about what Tuesday's outcomes mean for Governor-elect Janet Mills and her efforts to tap the support of a Democratic-controlled House and Senate to pursue her agenda. And, as always, we want to hear from you. Maine Calling is next. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. On a rainy election day yesterday, voters turned out in record numbers, and the results are in, for most of the races at least. This hour, we'll turn to our political analysts, including our Across the Aisle team, to offer insights on what Mainers said at the polls. Joining me in the first part of our discussion, Maine Secretary of State Matt Dunlap, and then in a few moments, Maine Public's political correspondents Mal Leary and Steve Missler. And as always, we want to hear from you. Were you surprised by any of the election results? How was your voting experience? Our number, 1-800-399-3566. You can also send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Joining me on the line now is Matt Dunlap, Maine Secretary of State. Thanks for calling in, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
So most people who voted yesterday, as we reported and discovered, encountered crowds and long lines, sometimes out the door. You projected that turnout would likely exceed the 2014 numbers. How did we finally end up, or do we know?
So we don't know the final numbers yet, and we won't for a while, as towns have a few days to get the results to us, and we have about 3 weeks to certify those. But nothing we saw yesterday would have caused us to project those numbers downward. In fact, if anything, we probably had higher turnout. And that's primarily because, you know, voters were incredibly engaged in this election, and we saw that coming, and we prepared for that eventuality. We did have a few hiccups here and there. We had some problems in about 21 towns with bulky tabulating machines, and the heavy turnout really amplified some of the wait times. But most of the people that I talked to were very determined. They wanted to have their voice heard, and they made sure they got their votes in. And nobody seemed to be terribly cranked up about the long wait times. And sometimes, like in Bangor, it was over an hour that people waited in line to cast their ballots. But people seemed to be in pretty good humor about it.
I wonder if you know this, how Maine ranks nationally in terms of processing and counting votes from its precincts. I noticed, I checked Vermont this morning and around 7:30 or 8, and I think 99% of the vote was in there. Do we lag behind peer states in processing the vote? And if so, by how much and why?
Well, to determine where we are in the rankings of reporting. We have talked about some ways to improve that process using election night reporting mechanisms that we could build into our central voter registration system. Unfortunately, things keep jumping in front of us, so we can't really get to that type of improvement. Like, for instance, you know, in the legislature and makes a change or the people adopt something like ranked choice voting, our attention has to be turned to implementing that. So we're largely a paper-based system, so it's difficult to automate that in a way that, you know, is secure. And that's one of the things that we are really focused on, is making sure that any process we introduce doesn't do anything to undermine the integrity of the election process.
So speaking of ranked choice voting, all eyes are on the second congressional district race, where Republican incumbent Bruce Poliquin and Democratic challenger Jared Golden appear to be in a dead heat. When will we know whether it will go to ranked choice voting, and how will that work?
Well, we'll probably make that determination here in the next couple hours based on, you know, the preliminary apparent results that have been reported by the towns and the media. We're going to start, if these numbers hold true, then we'll start tomorrow gathering materials and getting them to the Capitol and probably work through at least a part of the weekend and into the holiday on Monday to begin processing things, getting the memory devices from the tabulating machines downloaded into our closed-loop system and then scanning all the hand-count ballots. It'll take several days to do all that, and this is, of course, a larger election than what we dealt with in June, so we're not really putting a timeline to this. It'll take a little while to get all this done, but we'll make that determination. We're waiting for a lot of towns that are still actually counting ballots, giving them the courtesy to get their results, at least put together in a preliminary manner before we make the determination to go to the ranking system.
Now, because of the closeness here, only hundreds of votes separating the two at certain points, might there be a request for a recount as well? And how does that factor into the ranked choice voting system?
A recount request is really either or at this juncture. So a recount right now would not be appropriate unless one of the two major candidates crested the 50% mark and the challenger would then ask for a recount of that plurality result. Because under ranked choice voting, if somebody gets 50% plus one vote, you don't run the rankings. You just go with the majority winner. And then the person who apparently lost would then have the opportunity within 5 business days to request a recount. If they stay where they are, like in the mid-40s, well, we're not going to do a recount until we actually run the tabulation. And that would be through the ranked choice system. We have rules for doing a recount under ranked choice, something we've never done before. But we've thought a lot about how that would work, and we think it would be a process that people could trust. So it would not be until we finalize the tabulation under ranked choice voting that then you would look at a recount process of those ballots.
Have you been able to tell, even anecdotally, how well the voters did at ranking candidates? Did clerks have much to do with the polls to help people with confusion?
There was some confusion. It was not epidemic, mostly around, we've had the ranked choice election on one side of the ballot. And as you know, the only races that we were running with ranked choice voting were the federal races. So the state elections were and county elections, which were on the other side of the ballot, were not conducted by ranked choice voting. We did hear about a few circumstances where voters would inadvertently mark more than one bubble in the race for governor, and then they'd have to get another ballot. We don't know for certain if any of those overvoted ballots were submitted. We won't know that for some time now, but we didn't hear about any systemic problems with confusion about voting the ranked choice ballot, just some confusion about which races were ranked choice voting and which ones were not.
So we have a question from a listener, a final question here for you, who voted in gray and was asked for his ID. Even though he's a registered voter, he wants to know whether that was legal or not.
It is not something that is necessary. And, we don't have a voter ID law in Maine. And on election day, we answer a lot of questions like that. And we did answer the questions about the gray ballot clerks that were asking for IDs in order to obtain ballots. And we contacted gray and said that's not the law. I mean, people present identification to register, but not to obtain ballots. So that was corrected later on. We answer questions like that and also questions along the line of what candidates are allowed to say and do at the entrance to a polling place, what petition signature gatherers are and are not allowed to do in the polling place. That's why we have people on the phones all day on election day to answer those questions, mostly of local elections officials, but also from candidates and the general public when they see something like that. They're pretty good about alerting us so that we can talk to the local election warden and make sure that we're on the same page with what the law requires.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks, Matt, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Matt Dunlap is Maine's Secretary of State. And now we're joined by Maine public political correspondent Steve Missler and Mal Leary. Hey, guys. I know you both had a long night, as did we all, but we're forging on. So let's focus.
I test coffee.
That's right. Let's focus on three issues here, the governor's race, the second district, and the legislature as we look forward. First, Janet Mills has won, as we know. Now the hard part for her, though, is that she actually has to govern. What do you think she will lay down policy-wise as her opening hand here, or do you think we have to wait for her inaugural in January to find out what that agenda will be. Amal?
Well, I think to get to the whole agenda of what she wants to do, we're going to have to wait till January 2nd. But I don't think you'll see Janet Mills waiting around to start trying to advocate for some of the things she wants to do. I think you're going to see her as soon as the legislature organizes, elects its leaders, both Republican and Democrat. You're going to see her having meetings with those folks saying, for example, she's already said this, I want to get Medicaid expansion done right off the bat, first day, second day of the legislature, and get it done. So I think you're going to see those kinds of talks immediately. So we're going to see some things of her agenda as we progress, as she tries to put her cabinet together and all of the other things she has to do to get ready to run an administration. But the big issues, the overarching issues, she'll save for that inaugural on January 2nd.
Steve, do you think that she's talked a lot about early on in the campaign about reaching across the aisle and working with Republicans and, making that a priority. But does she need some, kind of a thing, a big thing around which to carry that out rather than just talking about it? And would Medicaid expansion be that thing? Could that work as something to draw in the Republicans?
I tend to agree that if she does want to have a bipartisan conversation with lawmakers, that she's going to have to have a big thing, as you put it. I don't think that Medicaid expansion is that thing because it's become such a polarized issue here in Maine and in other states across the country. Frankly, I mean, Republicans reject it. I mean, it became a litmus test during the GOP gubernatorial primary. Everybody was trying to go talk about how far they would go in actually repealing the Medicaid expansion law that voters passed in 2016. I don't know what that big thing would be, frankly, but I do believe that she would have to do something like that. I don't know if it would be some sort of tax reform. I don't know if she wants to wade into that, treacherous water or not, but that could be an example of something. She's talked a lot about healthcare and also climate change and renewable energy. A lot of those things have also become polarized. And a lot of this, of course, is shaped by the national conversations over those big ticket issues, because, like it or not, a lot of our local politics have been increasingly nationalized. And I think that was one of the reasons why you saw the results yesterday.
Yeah. Steve, she'll have support, unofficially, but I guess she will have support of Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate, which is an advantage in getting an agenda through. But are there other ways that having total party control offers Dems more power politically, say, over even in congressional races?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons why you saw so much outside money coming into legislative races this year. The big thing that's looming in 2 years is redistricting, congressional redistricting and the census. And Maine is one of two or three dozen states that state legislatures draw the map. And that's one of the reasons why in the previous years, Republicans had put so much effort into retaking state legislatures. I mean, during Obama's presidency, Democrats lost something like 900 legislative seats. And the result of that were Republican legislatures that were allowed to draw the 2010 redistricting maps, which in some cases were gerrymandered or very favorable. And those in turn helped Republicans in Congress hold on to the U.S. House. Now the Democrats have a chance at leveling that playing field, if you will. And that's one of the reasons why there was so much money coming in. And I think that, I don't know that Democrats want to go out and try to do their own gerrymandering exercise, but they might want to try to just at least level the gains that took place in other states. In Maine, it wasn't as severe a problem because the legislature was split just narrowly enough that it didn't become an issue. But that doesn't mean that that's not going to be a big issue going forward.
Mal, one issue that Governor-elect Mills could try to forward is the constitutional amendment to allow the extension of ranked choice voting to state elections. But that's not an easy prospect, even with control over both chambers, right?
Well, of course, because a constitutional amendment takes a two-thirds vote in both the House and Senate to even send it to the voters. And the Republicans have at least a third in both the House and the Senate where they could block, if they voted together as a unified group, they could block the constitutional amendment from going out to the voters. I do think you will see her try to put forward a constitutional amendment. She has said she would do that were she elected. But I'm not sure that's going to pass in either the House or the Senate, despite the fact that it will have the support of the governor and a majority of the legislature.
Yeah, I think Mal just hit a key point. The majority of Democrats, too. I don't know that Democrats are as united on ranked choice voting as they sometimes would like you to believe. I mean, we saw that when they were trying to pass a constitutional amendment or a repeal law 2 years ago or in the last legislature.
So speaking of ranked choice voting, on now to the second district, you heard the Secretary of State there a few minutes ago that the decision will be forthcoming within a few hours as to when to proceed on the ranked choice voting process in this deadlocked race in the second district. And while we don't know the outcome of who voted for what there, any sense of who's likely favored with this, either Poliquin or Golden, once these other votes are tallied in the first round?
Well, I think the conventional wisdom is that Golden would have the edge in a runoff simply because the two independents in the race, Tiffany Bond and Will Hoare, were sort of left of center, if you will, arguably left if they just happened to be independents, and that maybe their second place votes would go to Golden and then therefore push him over the finish line during the runoff. That's the conventional wisdom, but we really don't have any idea whether or not that'll shake out that way. It's if say Bruce Poliquin goes into the runoff rounds with an edge, he may just keep it. Who knows? It depends. I mean, there may have been a lot of voters who did what a lot of Republican voters did for him, which is just bullet vote. They picked one candidate and they were done.
Yeah.
And I think that's the issue that's going to plague this ranked choice voting, because we have no idea how many of Will Hoare's people marked a second or third ballot or Tiffany Bond. And we'll have to wait until they run the actual algorithm of the program for ranked choice voting to know that.
Poliquin has signaled, or there have been rumblings of a possible legal challenge of the outcome if Golden wins because of ranked choice voting. Have you heard any more about that since election night?
No, and it was just sort of inferred from a comment that he made during a debate, or a lack of a response, I should say, that he might challenge it. Who knows if he'll actually do that? But if he does, it's likely that he would try to go after what is called the Equal Protection Clause constitutionality argument, which has been settled in other states or other areas that have tried to test ranked choice voting's constitutionality. It hasn't been addressed in Maine, but the door was left wide open by one of the Maine Supreme Court justices. I think it was Alexander during the Supreme Court arguments over different issues with ranked choice voting, where he persisted on this issue, even though that wasn't really what they were addressing during oral arguments. And a lot of people paid close attention to that because they really felt like that sort of opened the door for a potential legal challenge on the equal protection issue, which could be very well what Bruce Poliquin tries to pursue.
I don't think there's any question that Bruce Poliquin will pursue a constitutional challenge if indeed he comes up short for re-election. And I've heard that from several prominent Republican figures. They're all going, oh yeah, he'll go to court.
All right, here's a big question, but only a few seconds remaining to answer it. Analysts have said all along nationally that this midterm is really a referendum on President Donald Trump. Do you see that based on results here in Maine in general that that's the case? Or do you think that these are local races with their own set of circumstances and determining factors?
Well, there are local determining factors, but I do think that a referendum on the president did have an impact on even, say, the governor's race, for example. I mean, Sean Moody alluded to that yesterday during his concession speech, where he talked about going to the polls and he got this sense that he was up against a really big headwind. And the way he described it was there were a lot of voters that were on a mission, is the way he described it. And I think that's very true. And I think that's one of the reasons why Janet Mills is the governor-elect.
And I think part of it's also reaction to Paul LePage in his 8 years. There's a lot of Democratic momentum there built up saying, we've got to have a Democratic governor to reverse some of the policies that he's implemented over the 8 years. So I think it's a combination of a Trump and LePage factor in our state, as opposed to other states where it was just Trump.
All right, Mal and Steve, the news day continues. I know you're busy. Thanks for stepping in here for a few minutes. Appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
Thank you.
Mal Leary is Maine Public's political correspondent. Steve Missler, Maine Public's State House Bureau Chief. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, your questions and comments. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield, committed to driving transformation for a healthier future for the people of Maine, anthem.com. And Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
Hey there, it's Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A. The news is often confusing, but not always. On 1A, we tell it like it is. We ask the tough questions and bring in guests that can shed light on the issues at hand. We are honored to be heard now on Maine Public Radio, Monday through Thursday nights at 9, just after Maine Calling. We'll have those important conversations about the hard stuff and the stuff with heart. We'll bring context and we'll make connections by listening to you. Join us for 1A, weeknights at 9, Monday through Thursday, here on Maine Public Radio.
One thing is for sure, nothing stays the same. The news and events happen and change constantly and quickly. Public radio plays a vital role. Over the years, Maine Public Radio has listened to you about what you want and need and has grown to be able to provide you with a valued and trusted service that keeps you up to date on what is going on and why. As a listener, you've grown and continue to grow by listening. Let's grow together. Do your part to keep public radio strong here in Maine. Our three-day Let's Grow Together membership drive starts next Tuesday, or you can contribute right now at mainepublic.org. Your financial support is a voice of support for the importance of public radio. Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Insights on the Election. Joining me in the studio now is our across-the-aisle team of political analysts. Cynthia Dill is an attorney who served in Maine's legislature as a Democrat. Meredith Strang Burgess is a former Republican lawmaker, now with Burgess Advertising and Marketing. And Dick Woodbury is an economist who served in Maine's legislature as an independent. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Welcome, guys. Cynthia, if you were the headline writer for the Dill Post-Dispatch, what would you put above the fold this morning?
Blue wave crashes on the shores of Maine.
So you think it was part of the blue wave?
Well, I think Maine had a blue wave. I don't think that that accurately describes what happened in the rest of the country. But in Maine here, I mean, the Democrats, Janet Mills obviously is going to be in the Blaine House. The Democrats have a majority in the Senate and the House, and that's a wave.
Meredith, what would the Strang Burgess bugle lead with today?
Well, unfortunately, that blue wave did hit, and it hit especially strong along the coast of Maine. So maybe it was more of a little tsunami here that kind of leveled out as it went inland. The Republicans still held in some of the rural parts of the state, but we clearly saw the coast become very, very blue.
All right. And Dick, what's the lead in the Woodbury Independent?
Well, I would have to say that it is a Janet Mills day. Janet Mills as our next governor, Janet Mills as the first woman governor of Maine, Janet Mills as governor over the state's bicentennial, which is coming up during her term, and Janet Mills as somebody who is going into office with very large Democratic majorities in the House and Senate, so an opportunity to absolutely shape the landscape of policy for the state going forward. So this is definitely a Janet Mills day.
My headline would be, political ads mercifully come to end.
For the moment.
So true.
For the moment.
I think we all agree on that.
And we'll get back to the governor's race in a second. But on the issue of ads, we heard from some ardent supporters of certain candidates who said, I really like this candidate a lot, but I'm very angry about the ads that they ran. Are we any closer at all to any sort of tipping point about people getting fed up with political ads, or Cynthia, or do you think they're just, we say this all the time, they're just effective and that's why we'll continue to see them every 2 years in perpetuity?
Not only are they effective for that small majority of people who are undecided and can be persuaded, but it's a cottage industry. I mean, the making and production of ads and the advertising industry, just there's just so much money involved that I don't see any end to it in sight.
What's odd, Meredith, though, is, and we've noticed this throughout, they don't match the tone of the campaigns.
Right.
In the governor's
right.
race, for example, it was relatively low-key and civil for the most part until the very end. But then you have at this other tier these ads that would make you think that everyone's at each other's throats.
And so true. And that carried on right from grassroots campaigns at the House right up and through. But where it really comes down to, and you said it, it's money, and it's third-party money. And if we really, really, really are serious about clean elections, we need to get rid of third-party money. And that's where you have a third party, and the way the laws are written, that the any third-party money has to be done totally separate and not in any way either knowledge by the campaign or any involvement from the campaign. And that's why they're so completely different.
And Dick, even with public funding, though, you can't really compete with the amount of advertising that's being produced as an independent. You just can't be in the game, or can you be in the game somewhat?
Well, there's no question that there is all kinds of money in politics that, you know, some of which is controlled within campaigns and donations to campaigns, but an awful lot of which is controlled and funded either by parties or by other independent groups. Now, when you mention other independent groups, it's not that you can't have another independent group that supports independence. So, you know, that's out there too. Coming back to your question about negative advertising, you know, it's certainly unattractive. But I did feel a little bit like in this race we are moving to a point where people are slightly more immunized from it. And just pay attention less to what it is and I don't know, figure out what they're going to do through other influences. You know, it still matters, but there's a little bit of a sense that we're starting to just ignore that.
Let's go back to the governor's race. Maine, for the first time, has a woman in the Blaine House, Cynthia, certainly significantly symbolic. But why has it taken longer to break through on this? Mills talked in her campaign about, you know, growing up near Margaret Chase Smith and even having a letter written from Margaret Chase Smith to her as a newborn saying, you have much to live up to. Why has the governorship been so elusive to women in Maine?
Well, I think people generally believe that women make good legislators, but have trouble sometimes imagining women as executives. And that's changing, but it's changing slowly. Janet Mills was able to have the perfect combination of attributes. She is not only the most qualified candidate, but she also brings to the position lots of experience and a certain degree of strength that is difficult to replicate by some female candidates. But why it happens, I think there's discrimination and bias that some people aren't even aware of deep within both political parties that makes it difficult for women to get ahead in executive races. She's obviously smashed the glass ceiling here in Maine, and I'm so pleased that we have in the first female governor someone with such competence and experience and strength. I think it's a great thing for Maine, and it's a great thing for women and girls and men.
Meredith, is it a different...
And boys,
is it...
And everyone in between.
So is being a U.S. senator, getting to be a U.S. senator just much more accessible than becoming a governor in Maine in particular?
Well, I think because it's that executive position. It's the CEO. And you look around the world at the number of women who are CEOs. It's a really hard step to make from being an officer or a senior officer to the CEO. And I think I'm going to speak a little bit probably for Cynthia, and that I know I've certainly heard women be really hard on other women, which is sort of an interesting piece, as well as, you know, probably men who are just like, I don't know. But I agree that Janet is the perfect candidate, where she's 100% qualified to be in this role. And I'm proud of her in the steps of history that she's going to make here.
Yeah. Dick, any thoughts?
Well, I want to say I'm proud, too. On the general, you know, why is it taking so long for women, I agree with everything that Meredith and Cynthia said. The other thing I'd just add to it is that we're in a very positive wave of women's engagement, particularly in politics. I just did a quick preliminary count of what the main House of Representatives is going to look like, for example. And I think we're going to have close to 60 women in the main House, which I suspect is a record. So, this is an exciting time.
The number, 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. We'll go to the phones in a moment. 1-800-399-3566. Meredith, back to you. Governor-elect Mills has talked throughout the campaign about reaching out across the aisle as governor to work with Republicans to get things done. Are Republicans prepared to do the same?
That's a great question. And I think the question will be, you know, what are the issues? But overall, I would like to think that everybody certainly is able to take a message and hear the tone. Clearly, we've talked about the mandate that Governor-elect Mills is stepping in with. And I think that certainly the beginning of the day, Janet's going to be a very thoughtful and also sort of really down the middle of the road governor. I think if you kind of come in and really adopt a very progressive agenda, I think that that's going to be met with a lot of conversation and a lot of long, hard work. But I think there's a lot of middle ground that we could get together and work with her.
So you've all worked under various scenarios, but in a case where you're a new governor and you have control, your party has control over the House and the Senate, is it not hard not to take advantage of that and then, you know...
Overreach?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm wondering.
That's the piece.
Is that the danger?
That is the danger, and that is the challenge. That's why on the national level, we've seen today President Trump applauding Nancy Pelosi, and there's belief by many that there could be potential for deal-making now that Nancy Pelosi is the leader of the House of Representatives in Washington, because she and Donald Trump can come together on some issues like infrastructure. Janet Mills, I think, has the wind behind her back in the sense that she is a Clinton delegate coming to the Blaine House. She is not a far-left Democratic candidate, and she has a reputation actually in the House. When she served with me in the House, she was a more conservative Democrat. People would generally think of her as almost a blue dog Democrat. Mm-hmm. So she has not only overcome, you know, majority of the votes in the state of Maine, but has overcome in the Democratic Party that went for Bernie Sanders, the party. So she's done a lot of work bringing the far left, I think, along with her campaign, but she's also brought along a lot of moderate independents who have broke for the Democrat in this election for the first time in a long time. And I think the numbers will show, as we hear more about the exit polling, a lot of Republicans who were concerned with the LePage administration and have experience working with Janet. But I just want to go back just for one second. Even though there's a lot of to celebrate around a first woman governor in Maine and some gains made, we still, you know, it's been a long time, and we have, you know, for the first time a woman governor in the Congress, there's still about 20%. So we still have a long way to go.
Yep. Let's go to Steve in Orono. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program.
Yeah. I would say my headline above the fold would be that Maine voters take back, drop the mic on what it means to be a real Mainer. And I think when I was standing in line to vote, people were upset with the president and the past of the governor, but really what I the consensus was, people were really upset that, is this really, am I living in Maine? Is this where we really have gotten to. It can't be that way. It really can't be that way. And I think what happened is we showed the country and the state of Maine that Maine is a great place to live, that we have passionate, inclusive, and sensible people that live here. And if you want to come and live here, you're going to be okay, no matter who you marry, who you love, who you vote for, what color your skin, and what original ancestry you have. And I think that's always been that way in Maine. And it's a happy day for me.
All right, Steve. Any thoughts?
Well, I mean, nice words, Steve.
Very nice words.
Was any of that, do you think, as the Secretary of State said, people seemed very motivated to get out in the rain and vote, and there was a lot of absentee ballots. Anything around the sort of the cultural tone?
Well, I would say today, perhaps looking at what happened with rose-colored glasses on, the mood is, like Steve said, a kumbaya moment. However, I think what was motivating a lot of people yesterday was anger and rage. You know, so we've had a switch in our emotional levels, but I think what drove a lot of people to the polls was anger. And
that was true around the country as
yes.
well. Yes. All right. We're going to take another quick break, but first a word about tomorrow's show. Our automotive experts will be back to talk about the latest in cars, trucks, and SUVs. Email your comments and questions to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance. Dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine, energy audit, and installation rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Salt Pump Climbing Company, helping to mentor the next generation of vertical athletes. Youth program information at saltpumpclimbing.com. And Faderly Law, dedicated to providing effective counsel on all matters of land use and real estate in Maine. Learn more at faderlylawmaine.com.
After fiercely fought midterm elections, we'll look at results, reactions, and what matters to voters.
It is healthcare, it is corruption, and it is rebuilding our country that people want us to stay focused on, and their expectation is that we get the job done.
I'm Elsa Chang. Who won, who lost, and the issues that will drive the country forward. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. Here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling, it's ideas from the CBC. Conservative with age. Why your political stripes change over time. If you're not a socialist at 20, you have no heart. And if you're not a conservative at 40, you have no brain. The saying has been around since at least the late 19th century. Ideas explores why this tendency exists and what it says about the way we acquire our political beliefs. Again, that's coming up at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling, right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're talking about election results and what they mean for Maine people. Joining me today are across the aisle team of former Maine legislators, Meredith Strang Burgess, Cynthia Dill, and Dick Woodbury. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Let's move on to the second district. Dick, was that race, do you think, a referendum on Donald Trump? As the second district is always based on what happened 2 years ago, and the support for Trump there is being viewed through Trump glasses. But was that about a referendum, do you think, on Trump or was it about the people of the second district and what's important to them and how they just came down on two different candidates?
Well, I think what people felt about President Trump was related to what happened in the second district, but I think it was broader. It was more about a sense of the country and what the country should be looking like going forward. And I just want to say a moment, as you know, while we're on the second district. This is almost certainly going to go to ranked choice voting, and ranked choice voting, you know, I believe in this race is going to do exactly what it's supposed to do. Is that instead of having one of the two win with, you know, whatever 46, 47% of the vote, it's going to determine which of these two candidates truly has the broadest support within the district. So, you know, so I'm, you know, I have my own speculation as to how that's going to come out. But whichever way it comes out, I feel like it's going to better represent what the people of the second district would like to have in their congressman.
Meredith, what's your take on the results or the soon to be results?
Soon to be results. Well, I think this definitely, you know, has the feeling of the national issues, but like Maine does so well, we are very passionate about our own candidates, even though they're representing us in Washington. People know their representatives, and there clearly was a huge difference of style that was at play here. We saw this playing out really over the last years here of Poliquin's style, which tends to be sort of the LePage-esque, Trump-esque style, which tends to sort of, you know, kind of say things but perhaps not be as accessible as Maine citizens like our representatives and our national representatives to be to us. And we saw Poliquin, you know, sort of bob and weave a little bit out there as far as that accessibility factor. So I think that was a huge piece, as well as obviously his stance on national issues.
Cynthia?
I think healthcare is what is going to drive Bruce Poliquin out of office if, in fact, he loses the election. I mean, Maine has voted consistently to expand Medicaid and has sent the signal that it wants expanded healthcare options for rural places. And Bruce Poliquin in office voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And all the polling nationally said that healthcare was one of the number one concerns of voters going into the booth. And even though question one on Maine's ballot, you know, failed, I think the Maine People's Alliance that and the groups that were, you know, campaigning for question one did a benefit to anyone who supports expanded health care and the Affordable Care Act, because it shined a spotlight on the needs of people in rural districts around health care. And I think that really, and finally, Bruce Poliquin, I think, made a political mistake by not embracing Donald Trump. I think he tried to have it both ways, of being, you know, a Trump supporter when he was down in Washington, but when he was up in his district, not necessarily making that connection. And I think he made a mistake.
I'd say that just a little bit differently, that it wasn't that he made a mistake by not choosing one side or the other. It was by trying to kind of have it all ways and not, you know, with greater conviction saying who he was.
Yeah, I think that's right.
All right, let's go to Brent in Portland. Hi, Brent. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. You're on the air.
So, you know, I've been old enough. I'm a type 1 diabetic. And so insulin and healthcare is really big and important to me. As well, my wife and I have a son with special needs. And underneath Barack Obama, I didn't see any change in my cost of living. Underneath Trump, I haven't seen any change in my cost of living. But what I've seen under both of these gentlemen is a big extreme, well, that's how Republicans are, or that's how Democrats are, and a real polarizing push. Now, that can go to media or whatever, but as far as my day-to-day life, I haven't seen any effects of either of their, you know, extreme or, you know, party politics. And I'm just wondering how, if it's a blue wave or a red wave or whatever color we want to call it, that really affects us in a day to day. I don't see it. I just see people getting angrier quicker and having a less ability to see it from the other side.
Yeah.
Well, Brent, if he has type 1 diabetes and he wanted to get health insurance because of the Affordable Care Act, he would not be discriminated against for having a pre-existing condition, thanks to the Affordable Care Act that was passed by President Obama and the Democrats in the United States Congress. So to suggest that there's really no difference between Obama and Trump, I think, is not true for a lot of people, and especially people in the 2nd Congressional District. They really see their lives are at risk if they have one medical issue that causes a bankruptcy. It's a spiral to poverty and income insecurity for so many people. It's a huge issue, and there's a huge difference between what the Obama presidency did for healthcare and what the Trump presidency is trying to do.
But it's important to remember, in the state of Maine, we passed, before the ACA became law, we have a no discrimination against pre-existing conditions. So Maine is already taken care of that and is insulated.
So, and not to get into a debate about the Affordable Care Act here, but I think Brent's point is also that people on all sides are concerned about health care and just want
absolutely.
Something to do something, to solve the problem.
Right, absolutely.
Not to speak for you, Brent, but is that sort of what you're saying?
I guess my biggest concern is, I have friends that are of every denomination, are from many different walks of life, friends that are atheists. I have friends from all over, all sides, all backgrounds. And I have yet to see any of my friends that are Democrat, as crazy as, say, Fox News would say that they are. And I've yet to see any of my Republican friends as extreme as, you know, some of the more liberal-leaning media is. So I guess my thing is, community is such a big part of my work and whatnot. How do we get our politicians to hear, you know, we don't want to hear these extreme commercials, for instance. We want to see what you're going to do to bring the community back together, and not just harp on, well, this guy, these extreme statements, if you don't align with my political views, you're detrimental for America, you know?
And I think and what happened in this last election, analysts have said centrists are being driven out of the House and the Senate in this past election.
Well, no, I don't know if that's true nationally. I think nationally, the actual centrist Democrats have done more, you know, better than some of the progressives. In Maine, that may be the case, but I think, well, we still have to do the analysis. But to Brent's last point, I agree with him that what you see on television does not reflect accurately the relationships with the people involved in politics in Maine. Most people get along. Most people are very civil and professional. And I hope, you know, that continues.
All right, let's go to Nicole, who's calling from Bowdoin. Hi, Nicole.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make the point that I think that a large part of the reason that we saw such a big blue wave here in Maine is reaction to Senator Collins's decision on Kavanaugh, and shows her and anybody else who's paying attention that Mainers stand up for what they believe in and are paying attention.
All right. Cool. Thanks.
Well, I just think that's one of the most interesting issues to look towards when Senator Collins comes up for re-election, whether or not her vote on Judge Kavanaugh will in fact have a difference, or if people are just going to forget. I mean, between now and then, he will have cast, made a lot of decisions on the Supreme Court that will affect Mainers one way or the other. But I think she raises a really interesting question, and I'm so interested to see how that actually unfolds when she is up for re-election.
Yeah, and it's interesting too when you look around the country at, you know, some of the Democrats who, by voting no,
right,
hurt themselves in other districts. I'm thinking North Dakota, for example, mm-hmm, where the Senate seat was lost by an incumbent Senate Democrat, in part attributed to the fact that she opposed the nomination.
Yes.
All right, let's go to Tom in Hollis. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I was listening earlier about the clean election, not clean elections, but the when people are campaigning and having the negative campaigning. I'm just wondering, what's the difference between the negative campaigning and bullying? It's hard to tell our kids today to not bully. Oh, it's easy to tell them not to bully, but it's difficult for them to hear the negative campaigning on TV and all the radio ads that sound very similar to what we're telling them not to do. I'm just wondering what is being done about that, or can be done about that in the future.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what can be done about it, but the point is also, for many adults, we might just hit the mute button and can't stand it anymore. But it is true, it brings into the home or into the car the sense that politics is accusatory and that it's about personal issues and the other person is bad and all of that messaging. It's
well, and in this election, what was really interesting is, as you know, there's on the national level, the Republican Party, or I think it was the Trump re-election campaign, put out an ad that was deemed so racist by networks, including Fox News, that they pulled it off the air. So there is a line, apparently. I mean, I personally am for a tighter regulation of what is, you know, allowed on advertising. I would like to not have to. I mean, to me, I don't know what's worse, a political ad or an ad for erectile dysfunction medication. To me, they're just the pits. I can't stand any of them. But I think I'm glad to see that at least at the national level, and locally we don't have the same kinds of racist ads, thankfully, that you have to deal with. But I hope to see some line drawing in the future that gets rid of some of this bullying, but I have a hard time thinking that with a conservative Supreme Court that we're going to have too many restrictions on speech in the coming decades.
And I think we've touched upon this in the past, but these ads are coming so fast and so furious that it's kind of hard for journalism organizations to do fact checks, mm-hmm. to vet, to verify. And by the time they've been aired, it's sort of already in the mind of the people. So it's sort of a helpless situation there in terms of other than urging viewers to use their own discretion in believing what they hear or do their own homework on some of the claims made.
Well, what lawyers have, and I'm curious to hear what Meredith has to say, is it seems to me the advertisers themselves could come together and do a little self-regulation.
And that would be a great idea. But I think you hit on it earlier, which is, freedom of speech. And so why does one candidate choose to sort of take a sort of a higher road? Then that becomes a point of difference in their campaign. And in the end, it's the voter who has the ultimate say. It's at the ballot box.
All right. We've got about 60 seconds left. So really briefly, Cynthia, what's the next storyline we should be looking here in this election?
Well, the elections for constitutional officers are going to be very exciting, and there's going to be some infighting among Democrats for leadership positions that we can. There's going to be a lot of debriefing on the Republican side.
Sorry to interrupt, but that's the Secretary of State.
Secretary of State, the Attorney General is going to be a contested race,
and that's elected by the legislature.
Yes.
Right. So, Meredith.
That and just really hear what our new governor's legislative agenda will be. And I think it's just really important for everybody to remember what we've learned. In 2010, we had a Republican House and Senate, and some of that new energy came in, and people really did try to go too far, right? And for, I think all of us were there, it was a really interesting time. As I can remember doing conversations with Dick, it was conversations within the Republican Party that were more divisive than anything.
Dick, 10 seconds.
The main House is going to have 30 more Democrats than Republicans, it looks like. The main Senate is going to have 5 more Democrats than Republicans. Sarah Gideon's the likely Speaker. Troy Jackson, the likely President of the Senate. We kind of know the three players. They're all Democrats. It's going to be interesting to see the policy agenda of this leadership team as it develops.
All right. Meredith, Cynthia, Dick, thanks so much.
Have a great week.
Meredith Strang Burgess, former Republican lawmaker, now with Burgess Advertising and Marketing. Cynthia Dill, an attorney who served in Maine's legislature as a Democrat. And Dick Woodbury, an economist who served in Maine's legislature as an independent. Sandra Harris ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the show, our automotive experts. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.